This podcast is brought to you by Luca Mele, front-end architecture, team leadership, and technical consulting. Over 16 years of experience turning complex challenges into simple, effective solutions. Learn more at lucamele.ch.
I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you've been tasked with building a fully functional, context-aware AI chatbot. Like for a production website.
Oh man, that is a heavy Jira ticket.
Right. If you're an engineer or an architect listening to this, think about what that actually looks like in your backlog right now. How long would you estimate it? A few weeks? Maybe a month?
At least a month.
Yeah, and what does the tech stack look like in your head? Oh. You're probably picturing setting up LangChain, maybe provisioning a dedicated vector database for context retrieval.
Probably installing like 3 or 4 different official SDKs.
Exactly. And planning some massive global state management overhaul for your front end. It's just universally treated as this massive undertaking.
It really is. The industry default right now is absolutely to treat any AI integration as like a major architectural event.
Yeah.
Development teams immediately start provisioning new microservices, bringing in highly specialized machine learning libraries, and suddenly this relatively simple web app has a massive infrastructure footprint.
Isn't it loons so fast?
It does. I see teams get completely bogged down in the tooling and the cloud provisioning before they even write a single system prompt. We've just sort of collectively assumed that complex capabilities inherently require complex infrastructure.
But what if they don't? Because today's deep dive mission is all about challenging that exact assumption.
Which I am very excited about.
Me too. We're looking at a really fascinating project by a front-end developer and architect named Luca Mele. He built a custom AI chatbot powered by Claude Haiku and deployed it to his production portfolio site.
And the timeline is the crazy part.
Yes. He did the whole thing from the initial idea to a live production deployment in one single session. We are talking about roughly an hour of focused work.
Which is frankly astonishing when you sit down and look at what this chatbot can actually do in production.
It's not a toy.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
This is not some generic wrapper that just passes your text to an API and says, hello, how can I help? It is a highly customized, heavily guarded conversational agent.
So, to understand how he pulled this off so quickly, we're taking his blog post that details the build, and we're cross-referencing it with his actual internal engineering best practices manifesto.
Which is a really cool document, by the way.
It really is. It's this living document he maintains that covers everything from Next.js routing strategies to his core testing philosophies. And for all the engineers tuning in, I want to be super clear here.
Yeah, this isn't a Hello World tutorial.
Right. This isn't just a basic guide on how to hook up an API key. This is a masterclass in architectural restraint. We're going to explore how strict, almost brutal engineering principles like you aren't going to need. It actually make this kind of lightning fast feature development possible. Okay, let's unpack this.
So the foundational secret to this entire project is restraint. When you look at how someone builds a backend for a contextual AI in just 140 lines of code, the trick isn't some magic new framework that writes it for you.
Right.
The trick is actively, stubbornly refusing to use shiny new dependencies.
I have to admit, when I first read his source code, I was genuinely skeptical. The entire backend for this AI agent is literally a single file.
Just one.
Just one. Yeah. It's a Next.js API route located at ApaChat. That's it. There is no Anthropic SDK installed in his package.json. There are no wrapper libraries.
Just a standard fetch call.
Yeah, a raw fetch call to Claude's Messages API, passed along 3 headers and a JSON body, and the client side. It's just 230 lines of pure React code using standard use state.
No Redux. No Zustand.
Zero external state management libraries at all. I looked at that and thought, wait, no SDK. Is it even a real integration if you aren't installing the official package? It's like wanting a glass of water and refusing to buy the fancy plumbing system or just holding a cup under the tap.
I completely understand that reaction. I mean, it feels weird to interact with a massive AI provider without using their official tools. But what's fascinating here is how that decision directly reflects the core tenets of his engineering manifesto.
How so?
Well, the Anthropic Messages API, at its absolute foundation, is just a clean JSON contract. You send a structured JSON payload, you get a structured JSON payload back.
Right, it's just standard web architecture.
Exactly. So adding a dedicated SDK, which, you know, brings its own dependencies, its own update cycle, and its own potential breaking changes just to hit a single post endpoint, is a textbook violation of YAG9.
That makes total sense.
In his best practices document, Luca heavily emphasizes what he calls the rule of least power.
Oh, I love that rule. Can you break down how he defines that for the listeners?
Yeah. So the rule of least power essentially dictates that you should always use the least powerful, least complex language or tool suitable for the needed result.
So don't over-engineer it.
Basically. If you can achieve a layout with basic HTML, use HTML. If you need styling, use CSS. Don't reach for JavaScript calculations. If you need interactivity, use plain JavaScript. And only reach for a heavy framework like React when the state becomes too complex to manage manually.
He treats architectural complexity as a finite budget. And he clearly extends that philosophy to his node modules. He literally has a separate blog post titled, "Reduce Your Node Dependencies for Maintainable Apps." He views every single package you install as a liability, not a gift.
It really is a liability. It's another thing your team has to update, another potential security vulnerability for Dependabot to yell at you about.
Ugh, the Dependabot alerts. That's
right. And it's another abstraction layer that can silently break your build pipeline. That philosophy is heavily optimizing for what architects call cohesion.
Okay, unpack cohesion for me here.
His manifesto stresses strong cohesion over weak cohesion. By keeping this entire chatbot feature self-contained, so a single API route and a single React component, it becomes incredibly cohesive.
So if something breaks, it's easy to find.
Exactly. If a user reports that the chat is broken, a new developer on the team knows exactly where to look.
Yeah.
They aren't tracing opaque data flows through global state managers, and they certainly aren't digging into the minified source code of a third-party SDK to figure out how the vendor implemented their network retry logic.
The code is entirely local.
Entirely.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. If the architecture is just a simple fetch call on the back end and a couple hundred lines of standard React on the front end, where is the smart part?
Right, where's the brain?
Yeah, where does the actual intelligence of this application live? Because it shifts entirely out of the code base and into the system prompt.
It really does.
It's like, instead of trying to program every single footstep, hand gesture, and facial expression of an actor with thousands of lines of explicit code, you just hand that actor a hyper-detailed 50-page character backstory before pushing them out on stage.
That is a brilliant analogy, and it represents a massive paradigm shift for software architecture. In modern AI applications, natural language is the new configuration file.
That's a great way to put it.
The logic of the application has basically moved from JavaScript into English. The reason this chatbot doesn't feel like a generic wrapper is because the prompt is massive. It's around 3,000 tokens long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it essentially downloads Luca's entire professional identity into Claude's context window before the user even types a single word.
And I am so curious how deep that prompt goes. Like, if he isn't using a vector database to search through his resume dynamically, how does the bot know anything about him?
He just hard-codes the context directly into the system instructions.
Just right in the string.
Right in the string. The prompt contains his entire CV, including 9 distinct chronological career positions with dates and responsibilities.
That's a lot of detail.
It is. It contains his specific educational background, explicitly outlining his Master of Advanced Studies in Software Engineering and his Certificate of Advanced Studies in Front-End Engineering.
Okay, so it has his resume.
But it goes way beyond just reciting a resume. It is primed with his actual management and leadership philosophies.
Right. The source material mentions he feeds it theories like the Johari window, the 9-box grid, and pack.
Yeah, those are pretty deep cuts.
They really are.
Yeah.
If you're an engineer listening, you might not have encountered these, but they are deep HR and management frameworks. The Johari window is a tool for mapping self-awareness and blind spots. The 9-box grid is a matrix used to evaluate employee potential versus current performance.
And PAC.
PAC-C stands for Parent Adult Child, which is a transactional analysis model for understanding communication dynamics. He injected all of this into the prompt.
Which means the bot doesn't just know where he worked, it knows how he thinks. It even knows the key arguments of all 10 of the technical blog articles he has written.
Wait, really?
Yes. A user can literally debate his own architectural opinions with the bot, and the bot will defend Luca's actual viewpoints using his own frameworks.
That is so cool. But shifting all of that intelligence to a natural language prompt creates a completely new vulnerability surface, doesn't it? If the prompt is the product, the prompt is also the primary security risk.
Oh, absolutely.
Which brings us to a crucial engineering detail. The privacy guardrails. The system prompt explicitly forbids the model from revealing his home address, his phone number, his exact birthday, or his marital status.
Good call on his part.
Yeah, and if a user tries to push the bot for that personal information. It's instructed to hard redirect them, telling them to reach out via email or LinkedIn instead.
That explicit boundary is so critical because large language models are inherently people pleasers. They are statistically weighted to be helpful.
They just want to answer the question.
Exactly. If you do not explicitly tell an LLM not to do something, it will happily, creatively hallucinate or leak private information just to give the user a complete satisfying answer.
It's terrifying, honestly.
It is. This is why testing these natural language boundaries is becoming just as critical as any traditional end-to-end UI test.
But how does he actually test that, though? You can't write a standard unit test for an LLM hallucination.
Well, if we look at his best practices manifesto, his testing strategy relies heavily on using tools like Playwright to run tests against mock servers, specifically focusing on the extremes.
What counts as an extreme here?
For an AI integration, the extremes aren't just weird button clicks or unexpected null values. The extremes are users actively trying to socially engineer your prompt.
Oh, like prompt injection.
Right. You configure Playwright to intercept the network request, mock a scenario where the AI tries to return restricted info, and assert that the UI correctly handles the fallback. You have to rigorously test the guardrails because the LLM is a non-deterministic black box.
Okay, so we have a brilliantly detailed 3,000 token system prompt, and we have a brutally simple architecture, literally just a fetch call. But the real world is messy.
Very messy.
I want to talk about how he handles standard production issues like memory, rate limiting, and complex UI rendering without breaking that strict zero dependencies rule. Let's look at the conversation history first. Initially, the blog notes that he built it completely stateless.
Which meant that every single time you sent a message, Claude was evaluating that specific sentence in a total vacuum.
Goldfish memory.
Exactly. If you asked a complex technical question, got an answer, and then typed, "Can you explain that further?" The model had absolutely no idea what that referred to. It completely destroys the illusion of an actual conversational agent when it has amnesia every 5 seconds.
So how does he fix it without spinning up a Postgres database to store chat logs? He takes a wonderfully pragmatic approach.
Classic ERGNI.
Yep. He caps the history at 50 messages, and the client-side React code sends the entire array of previous messages back to the Next.js API on every single request.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he just lets Claude's massive context window do the heavy lifting of remembering the conversation. It's a great workaround. But then there's the abuse problem.
Yes. The billing attack.
As he puts it in the blog, exposing a public AI endpoint is essentially putting a credit card attached to a public endpoint. You can't just leave that unprotected on the open internet.
No, you really can't. And this is where we see the IAJAM principle really put to the test. He absolutely needs rate limiting to protect his wallet.
Right.
Now, the standard enterprise architecture approach here would be to spin up an Upstash Redis cluster or use Vercel KV to track IP addresses and rate limits across global edge nodes.
That's what I would have done.
But he actively chose to avoid that route. It would add a third-party service connection and a new database dependency that he doesn't actually need for a personal site. Instead, he builds an in-memory rate limiter using a simple native JavaScript map object right inside the API route.
Wait, hold on. I have to push back on this on behalf of every cloud architect listening right now.
I figured you might.
If he deployed this to Vercel, Next.js API routes are stateless, serverless functions. A JavaScript map object lives in the memory of the specific container handling the request. When that container spins down due to a cold start, or if a load balancer routes the next request to a different container, that map object gets wiped completely. The rate limit resets. How is an in-memory map a viable rate limiter in a serverless environment?
That is the exact architectural tension he is playing with, and it is a brilliant example of pragmatic trade-offs.
I'm listening.
You are entirely correct about serverless cold starts. If this were a banking application or an enterprise SaaS product with strict SLAs, an in-memory map would be a catastrophic failure of system design. You would absolutely need a globally synchronized data store like Redis.
Right.
But this is a personal portfolio site. If we connect this to the bigger picture, his goal isn't to enforce sub-millisecond globally synchronized rate limiting across a cluster of servers. His goal is to stop a single malicious script from spamming his endpoint and running up a $1,000 Anthropic bill in 10 minutes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. If a container stays warm while a script is hammering it, the map object catches it and returns a 429 status code.
And blocks the spam.
Exactly. If the container spins down and forgets the IP, the worst case scenario is the attacker gets a few more requests through on a cold start before the new container catches them. The business requirement is prevent bankruptcy, not perfectly track every IP globally.
That makes a lot of sense when you frame the business requirement that way.
Mm-hmm.
Reaching for Redis would solve a problem he doesn't have yet, which violates his core rule.
Exactly.
Speaking of complex requirements, let's talk about the UI rendering.
Mm.
Because when people ask the bot technical questions, Claude naturally spits out markdown formatted text with embedded code blocks.
Of course.
If you just render that as plain text in a React component, it looks terrible. It's just a wall of unreadable characters.
And the immediate reflex for almost any front-end developer in that situation is to open the terminal and type npm install React Markdown, and then probably pull in a massive syntax highlighting package like Prism or highlight.js to make the code blocks look pretty.
Literally muscle memory at this point.
Right. But again, that completely violates his core rule. Reduce your node dependencies.
I am so glad you brought that up because this part blew my mind. I was reading the source code, and I kept wondering, why go through the pain of writing a custom tokenizer instead of just installing a library? He literally wrote his own lightweight single-pass tokenizer right there inside the React component to manually handle the syntax highlighting for JavaScript, CSS, and HTML.
To understand why he did that, you have to understand what those markdown libraries actually do under the hood. Libraries like Remark or Rehype don't just magically bold text. They parse your entire string into an AST, an abstract syntax tree.
For the listeners who might be rusty on compiler theory, can you explain what an AST is in this context?
Sure. Imagine you want to paint the door handle of a car. An AST approach would be like disassembling the entire car into its individual nuts, bolts, and panels, laying them all out on a giant warehouse floor, finding the door handle, painting it, and then reassembling the entire car.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. It breaks the text down into a massive, complex tree of nodes representing every paragraph, sentence, and code block, applies transformations, and turns it back into HTML. It is incredibly powerful, but it requires shipping a massive amount of JavaScript to the client. Luca decided that for a simple chat window, disassembling the car was overkill.
But building your own tokenizer is notoriously tricky. He even admits in the blog that he fell into a classic rejects trap.
Oh yeah, the sequential replace issue.
Yes. He initially tried to parse the markdown using sequential replace calls with regular expressions. But because they ran one after another, the later rejects started accidentally matching the HTML span tags that the earlier rejects had just injected into the string. It was a complete mess, breaking the rendering entirely.
Which is exactly why he had to rewrite it as a strict single-pass parser.
How does that actually solve the rejects collision problem?
So a single-pass parser works by moving through the text character by character from left to right exactly one time. It identifies a chunk of text, classifies it as a keyword, a string, or plain text, wraps it in the correct styling tag, and moves on. Because it never looks backward, it is physically impossible for it to accidentally reprocess its own injected HTML tags.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's fast, it's incredibly lightweight, and it requires zero external libraries. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it perfectly mirrors his Next.js architectural rules.
So?
Well, his manifesto explicitly states that UI components should be holistic and testable with a strict single responsibility. By keeping the markdown parser custom and entirely local to the chat component, he avoids dependency bloat and ensures the component does exactly one thing: render chat messages. It is strictly tailored to his actual business requirement, nothing more.
So what does this all mean for the final product? Every architectural choice has trade-offs.
Oh.
We've seen how this ruthless simplicity made it cheap and fast for the developer, zero dependencies, using native tools already in his stack like Next.js APIs, the standard Fetch API, and Tailwind CSS. But what does that mean for the person actually visiting his portfolio? Did the user experience suffer?
Surprisingly, the user experience is fantastic, primarily because the complexity budget he saved on the back end was spent entirely on polishing the UI.
Oh, interesting.
It doesn't look like a generic, faceless SaaS widget slapped onto the bottom corner of the screen. He designed it to feel deeply personal. The chat bubble uses his actual headshot, but he layered it with a visible AI badge and a purple overlay.
So it's obvious it's a bot.
Exactly. It is immediately transparent that you are talking to an agent, not the real Luca. He even added a subtle green online indicator to make it feel alive.
And he recognized a really common pain point. A tiny little widget box is a terrible place to try and read complex code blocks.
Oh, I hate that.
Me too.
Mm.
So he built a full screen toggle. You click an expand button and the chat takes over the viewport, capping the width at max W3SL so the code blocks stretch out and become actually readable. It shows a deep empathy for the developer experience of his users.
It really does.
And all of this is running on Claude Haiku, which is insanely cost-effective. Even with pushing that massive 3,000-token system prompt on every request, it's costing him between 1/10 and 3/10 of a single cent per message.
Mm-hmm.
He is paying maybe a few dollars a month in total cloud costs.
But we do have to acknowledge that the trade-offs of this lean architecture are real. There are standard features he intentionally left on the cutting room floor.
Like what?
For example, there are no persistent conversations. If a user closes the browser tab, their entire chat history is gone forever. Now, he could have easily used browser local storage to save the array, but he reasoned that he wasn't sure users even wanted their casual chats with a portfolio bot saved on their machines.
That's fair. Another big one is the lack of streaming responses. When you ask this bot a question, you just see a static loading indicator until the entire paragraph is generated, rather than watching the words magically stream onto the screen in real time like you see on ChatGPT.
Right. He acknowledges he could fix that by switching the client to consume a readable stream, but for a version 1, it just wasn't strictly necessary to prove the concept. And this raises an important question about how we structure modern web applications, particularly in the Next.js ecosystem. If you look at his best practices document regarding server versus client components, he has a very strict dichotomy.
Oh, the Next.js app router rules. Let's dig into that.
Yeah. His rule is simple. If a page contains content that is relevant for SEO, it must render on the server so search engine crawlers can index it without executing JavaScript.
Makes sense.
But if a component involves heavy user interactions, time-based data, or private content that Google shouldn't index, it must be a client component.
And the chat is definitely private.
Exactly. Because this chatbot is entirely conversational, private to the user, and irrelevant to Google's search index, keeping all of this state entirely client-side isn't just a lazy shortcut. It is a perfect intentional alignment with his own enterprise architecture rules.
It really is a perfect marriage of high-level philosophy and gritty execution. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I think the core takeaway for the listener is that building a genuinely useful AI integration does not require a massive infrastructure overhaul.
Definitely not.
The hard part of software engineering is no longer standing up the technology stack. The hard part is crafting the natural language system prompt to make the bot actually useful, and having the sheer engineering discipline to keep the architecture brutally uncomfortably simple.
The restraint is the feature. By actively saying no to SDKs, saying no to Redis databases, and saying no to heavy state management libraries, he was able to ship a high-quality, production-ready product in a fraction of the time it takes most engineering teams to simply hold their first architecture planning meeting.
And that brings me back to where we started. I want you to think about your current engineering backlog for a second. If an entire conversational AI agent, complete with custom privacy guardrails, custom single-pass syntax highlighting, and a complex professional persona can be built and shipped to production in a single afternoon, using just 370 total lines of code and zero new node dependencies.
It's wild to think about.
Look at the Jira tickets your team is working on right now. How many of your complex multi-sprint features are actually just simple API calls buried underneath layers of unnecessary architectural hype and plumbing you simply did not need?
A lot of them, probably.
It is definitely something to think about the next time you blindly reach for that NPM install command. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Sure.
We will see you next time.